when it doesn't matter how many goals you concede in the first half, as long as you score four in the second. That's So MLS, a North American soccer podcast with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
Nick Hagland. Yeah.
Defensive Toronto attacking superstar Nick Hagland. You can find this podcast on iTunes and wherever podcasts are acquired for a fourth round draft pick at That's So MLS. ThatsSoMLS.com.
Yeah. That's us.
Nick, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's hotter than hell here in Vancouver. World Cup is underway. I have not watched a single match so far. Not necessarily by choice, but as I think may be a theme throughout our season, is it's really difficult to watch matches if you don't have a television and don't pay for cable.
I have
all kinds of nefarious ways of watching soccer, and it's not worked out for me. So.
My non-nefarious way of watching TSN had a little bit of a hiccup due to an account issue, but we're back.
So back in action. But we're not going to talk about the World Cup.
No, we're not.
We're going to talk about everything but the World Cup. We're going to talk some MLS, including some news. And we're going to talk about USL, which we haven't talked about hardly at all this year so far. And we're going to talk about NWSL as well.
Yeah, so it turned out kind of with the MLS 9-day break, we were talking about it last weekend, but there was still a suite of games on Wednesday. So in the end, 9 days only really covers one weekend because you play games on Wednesday, you don't play games on the next Saturday or Wednesday, and next weekend we got Saturday games again, including a couple of high-scoring affairs and a couple of surprising results. So I think the craziest game of the lot was definitely Toronto FC 4, DC United 4, which I got to watch at the time. Did you get to see any of this?
I did. I mean, I kind of had to. I had to go back and watch it after the fact. I didn't see it live. And it's always hard when you sort of see a game happening. And, of course, it's a Canadian game, so it wasn't available live on DAZN. But this seemed like it didn't seem like it was a game where everything just seemed to not be going Toronto's way. And then they're able to somehow magically turn it around, only to then go behind in the 90th minute and then somehow scrape a point out of this match.
Yeah.
Before we get into the just balls to the wall, weird stuff that went down. Actually, no, let's get into that first and then I'll ask you my question later.
Okay. So the long and short of it was that DC scored twice very early in the first half. I think from the 10th minute to the 16th minute, they scored twice. And then I have that those were pretty simple. I did have notes about this. I just have to find them.
It's all right.
And then just beforehand, just before the end of the first half, Darren Maddox absolutely robs Zabaleta.
In possibly one of the most embarrassing defensive blunders I've seen in a season of terrible defending across the league, this one was truly bad. And from a veteran defender as well, it was really quite shocking what happened.
So those two goals, those are like crazy things one and two to happen this game. Crazy thing one is that DC scores on 12 and 17 in two goals in 5 minutes. Crazy thing, too, is Maddox just decided that he had the ball now. Like, it had been a bad half for Toronto, and they were truly very poor.
Although I do think Emil Assad's first goal is a great goal.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was poor marking, for sure. But I felt like that was all DC just doing the right things. It was the Paul Areola goal that just seemed to be like Toronto decided maybe if we just don't mark anyone and see what happens, But the first Assad goal, I thought, okay, fair play to DC. They've come in, they're playing an away game, they haven't had a great season, but they do have great players, they can score goals, they're taking it to Toronto. The second goal is just sort of catching Toronto a little bit deflated and sleeping. But the Maddox goal was just, as you said, he just makes up his mind, okay, it's mine now, takes it, and scores just a nice little low shot into the corner. And all of a sudden, you're going into the second half, 3-0 down at home to DC United, sitting bottom in the East.
So they had already been doing so badly in the half, like 2-0 on the Toronto FC rehabilitation tour. They really did. I really was thinking, like I had said from the off season, you know, focus on the Champions League. You can make it back later, even after they had it. Even after they got back and there was all the injuries, I was still thinking, it doesn't matter where you get in the playoffs as long as you get in. But they really did look like a fundamentally different team. And they, like, heading into that, it wasn't just the fact that Maddox had unseated them. It's that there was so much pressure. There was so much overwhelming pressure at the end of that half. And not to insult DC, but it's DC, right? Like the commentary is saying, like, you know, just beforehand is showing Vanny and saying, like, oh, Vanny is a little frustrated because it would be like he's got to get the team into the dressing room so that he could talk to them without any further damage. And then immediately they concede. And it's like, it seems, I mean, as much as I say it's DC, I guess they're next to each other in the table with 10 and 15 points respectively. But, or I guess it would have been even 10 and 12 respectively. So maybe turning up their nose at them is not even the best thing. But they looked so much better than TFC. And that's not, DC United looks so much better than Toronto FC is not a sentence I expected to say at the beginning of the year.
No, and I think you're spot on with that, and I would also say they still looked better even during the comeback. You know, we saw all the familiar DC mistakes rear their ugly heads, where they're just failing to clear the second ball, failing to mark guys in the box. But you know, I would say even the tying goal from Nick Haglund, is a defender, there's really not much you can do about somebody that big that just comes in and decides, I'm scoring a goal right now.
Right.
And credit to Nick Haglund to do that and to just go, okay, it's time to end the madness. We got to get something out of this game, and just decides it and finishes it and just plows through the center back or the defender marking him, who was marking him. Yeah. He just used that guy as leverage to get over him.
That comes from a nice, play as well from Jonathan Osorio, who had the first goal. He sort of dummied a ball that falls to Moro, who got him on that header.
Yeah, and I would say too that for me, one of the turning points of this game was the second Toronto goal from Victor Vasquez, which just, again, a poor clearance. Nobody's marking outside of the box. We've seen it time and time again. Nobody's ready for the second ball. Osted looked really out of sorts on the three remaining Toronto goals.
Juvinko hit a ball off the crossbar to Vasquez, and it looked pretty nice. Yeah. Almost like you planned it.
Good play in the end. my question to you about this game is that everybody's talking about just what a buck wild comeback this was for Toronto, and what a show of team spirit.
Just to complete the walking through of it, it was Haglund scored that tying goal on 86. Assad scores 5 minutes, 4 minutes later on 90. Another terrible dispossession for Michael Bradley. And then Haglund scores on 90 plus two. So in 8 minutes, you had three goals from two different teams.
Well, and the almost winning goal from DC, there's three defenders on Assad, and nobody can stop him, including Michael Bradley, who has his arms all over him and is basically trying to bear hug him to the ground because that's all he can do as a defender. And Assad still gets through and scores the goal. However, is this a glass half full or glass half empty thing here? Should we be excited about a 0.1 from a game where you go 3-0 down and come back to draw the game 4-4? Or should we look at this as something different, which is if you're going to struggle this badly and give up this many goals to a team that you're ultimately still 5 points clear of at the bottom of the table, boy, are there still dark days ahead.
I think the issue remains an issue of defense. It's finally, you have two central defenders in there. They have reverted somewhat to their MLS Cup final shape of having Bradley sit both as a defensive midfielder that can kind of drop back to be a fifth defender. But Bradley looked good at that in 2017. And I don't know if he just really if just the stress of having to be an actual center defender has made him worse, but he didn't look great in this game. Gregory Vanderbilt was playing on the left-hand side to cover for somebody else who was injured. I can't recall. So, they're not quite in their perfect world yet. I think it's Mavinga. If Mavinga comes back next week, Vanderbilt can switch back over and then you can maybe continue to evolve the Zavaleta-Haglund pairing. I think that the key is to just create a form of consistency and get people used to playing with each other again.
I guess so. But, I mean, isn't that what squad depth is for? Considering how much Toronto had to rely on it last year and was talked about a team that had so much depth, I guess I'm finding it confusing that, okay, on the one hand, they're showing their depth by having people like Osorio and Nick Haglund step up to gain a crucial point. But where is the depth in midfield or the depth at the back? And I know Toronto's had a ton of injuries, but so have other teams. This just seems to be a complete lack of ability to adapt. And for me, I see this as a match that Toronto can take some positives from.
Yeah.
But you could see the frustration on Vanny's face for this whole match that the team all but gives up at the back. There's just no fight whatsoever to defend. And it seems like regardless of what the game plan is going in, the defenders on the field aren't able to execute it. And if you're having to score 4 goals to get a point out of the worst team in MLS right now, how does that bode for coming up against some of the other teams in the East?
Yeah.
It's just, for me, increasingly looking like it's just not going to happen. And as much as even a few weeks ago, MLS Soccer is talking about, soccer.com is talking about how, well, don't write off Toronto just yet. You know, a couple of things could change and then they're pulling into high gear. But we talked about now they had an easy stretch of games coming up and the first one they shit the bed.
So it's hard because this was the easy game and it was a home game. You definitely could have got 3 points out of it. And they've got to start, as much as I say, you can, it doesn't matter where you get in as long as you get in.
Sure.
The East is kind of stacked right now. In terms of who are you displacing on the way up there? Which team, if you look at the top six, Atlanta, New York, Columbus, New York, New England and Orlando are the top six. Well, maybe you could knock out Orlando because they've been having some issues, but Chicago is ahead of you in doing that. Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Montreal are ahead of you, and maybe you could kind of outdo them. But this is the thing about that first half is that the magic of Toronto FC that continues to exist is that no matter how bad they fuck up, they can kind of like figure it out. Which I guess would itself lend to narratively nicely the idea of them being able to get into the playoffs. But I think,
and it's like, it's still mathematically possible. And like, don't get me wrong. I mean, they're only 4 points behind Chicago and Orlando. Both of those two teams have been just having a terrible run of games also. The difference is Chicago and Orlando have also had bright spots to the season where Toronto hasn't.
Let's make a couple. I have a couple of judgments to make about Toronto at this point. Okay. One of them,
judge away, my friend.
One of them is that we talked a little bit when they were in the Champions League about the idea of sort of like TFC 1 and TFC 2, where they were playing pretty much their MLS Cup final lineups with a few tweaks in the Champions League, and they were sort of blooding this sort of like B team in the league, which we thought, oh, well, when the rubber hits the road, that'll give them some experience. I think that the new players that they brought in to every team has to evolve and has to have new pieces plugged in and replenish itself from year to year. You can't just have the same lineup forever. But I think that some of the players that they acquired have not their acquisitions in the off season have not, I don't think, been up to snuff. And I
agree. I think they've been a total bust.
I think that there is the danger sometimes of just seeing a player in the wrong place at the wrong time so much. So I don't want to harp too much on Aro, but I don't think Aro is that great. But no. You know, I feel like he ends up in the wrong place at the wrong time so much. So that's number one. That's judgment number one. Number two is just a recognition of how important Drew Moore was to this team, mm-hmm. who's still out with a quadriceps strain. I don't know exactly at this point what his prognosis is for coming back, but I think that when you looked at that era of the beginning of the season when they were doing both, the A team and the B team, Drew Moore was playing on each one, and then he tore his quad. And that was unfortunate for him and
but he's a fullback, isn't he?
No, he's the central defender. He's the central defender.
Oh, is he? Okay.
When they were playing three at the back sometimes in the last 2 years, he was the central defender. He's their
right.
I think he has been the linchpin. It didn't help that all of their other defenders got hurt at the same time, but you know, Eric Zavaleta is not Drew Moore. That's just the way that it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and their recent run of form has also just highlighted how much, as good as a team can look and can seem like they have depth, you do. It's easy to overlook the spine of a team that has such a great effect. Mm. And, you know, I mean, I don't feel qualified to sit here and say, you know, which individual piece is the one that makes the team magic or shit. But I think we've seen with Toronto is what we thought was possibly squad depth. And certainly some of that came into play is that we're still seeing that largely just within the front four. And as we perhaps transition towards another team with similar problems in Orlando, the observation I've begun to make is so I think it's fair to say that MLS is really a team about, or is really a league about attacking teams and that sort of front four, that front five.
They've definitely,
especially up the wings. If you're a team that has pace up the wings, you can do very, very well in MLS. And teams have spent a lot of money on players that can play out wide and make very dangerous runs in those wide spaces. However, you'd think that that would mean that teams would pay equal attention to getting stalwart, versatile fullbacks. And yet, the exact opposite seems to be true. This is where teams consistently spend the least amount of money and are offloading the players that cost that much. So you've got these expensive, talented, versatile players bombing forward on the wings. And then teams, in terms of their fullbacks, a player like Betashur has skipped around team to team. And sure, he's getting older, but is also one of the most proven MLS fullbacks in the league. And you don't want to pay his salary. And immediately, you see the space that gets exploited by teams this season. And so, you know, I know it's MLS and money's tight, But it does seem interesting to me that you'd think there'd be an equal amount of investment in training, salaries, trades, whatever, for decent fullbacks. And yet that seems to be continually where MLS teams find space to exploit.
I think that is a, when you say MLS is a team all about attack and attacking tees and attack on the wings, I think that that is not just, I think that that's been intentional by some of the changes that have been suggested from the league, the way the league salary cap works, what they suggest that you do. I'm looking for that list of players that got denied on TAM. That there's a reason. You know, Jovan Jones was one of them, who is a defender. Stefan Fry is a goalkeeper, was another. I think that there is a organizational, the this is true at an organizational level. And I,
yeah.
Why does Betashore jump around so much? Well, I don't know. He has proved his worth wherever he can. I think that if you look at the issue in Toronto, he was not shipped out of Toronto because he didn't deliver. He was shipped out of Toronto because his value exceeded what they were able and willing to pay.
Yeah.
So that's the.
But my thing is like.
And that's an organizational decision.
It is. But when you look at the teams that are doing very, very well and are incredibly good in attacking areas as well as defensive, they've got great fullbacks. Sporting Kansas City. They have an incredibly expensive back line. There's a reason for that. There's a reason why they concede so few goals. They don't have a shitload of expensive midfielders or forward players. The money is sort of a little bit more evenly distributed, and they can build out of the back. And especially in a league that's so built on the counterattack, you need your back line to be a part of that. So it's not just in terms of absorbing pressure, you know, playing this sort of old school Chelsea system of parking the bus. It's about, in order to move forward, you need strong players at the back to help you do that.
Yeah, if you this is why I'm kind of pinning it on MLS a little bit. You're right. Smart teams do this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
The four players that we were talking about last week, as reported by Paul Tenorio of The Athletic, are CJ Sapong. So that's the exception in terms of being an attacker. Tim Parker, Walker Zimmerman, Stefan Fry, and I think somebody said Jovan Jones. So four defensive players out of five denied out of TAM. And
yeah.
Ousted.
Yeah.
Right? Again, that's not where MLS wants people putting their money.
Yeah. Ugh, a shame. Well, speaking of not talking about one team for 20 minutes, as we've
well,
done.
Well, I mean, it's the big news.
We're talking about for the broadcast.
It's the big news.
No, I'm doing a callback to a thing people weren't present for. So in a battle of worst defenses in the league currently, Montreal faced Orlando. And to me, this one was kind of like toss a coin. I mean, it could have been a 0-0 draw or a 5-5 draw. Instead, it was a complete rout by Montreal. What did you make of this match?
I think the first thought that occurred to me, I didn't see it on the day. I heard it reported at the time, and I went back and watched the highlights now. I have written down, the first thing I wrote down on Wednesday was Impact needed that penalty luck. That first goal that breaks a dry spell for Piatti. They needed that so bad. They have been on the opposite side of it. I eventually wrote down that Orlando looked like Montreal. Like all of the mistakes that Orlando made, the penalty, the own goal, were kind of characteristic things that you've been seeing out of Montreal week by week. Which eventually Montreal did capitalize on. Two of the goals came from more from Orlando than Montreal, and being a penalty than an own goal. But Piatti, it certainly appeared to wake up Piatti, who had a great move with Saffer Tider. Tider, for once, not being on the bad side of penalty and defensive mix-ups. But in the end, it was an one-on-one play with Piatti that, for the third goal. Looked great. They really needed that. And it turned out to be a rather monumental result in terms of Orlando.
What would come next? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I want to say, too, that third goal, I mean, it's just... This summed up everything that's been wrong with Orlando lately, and not just on their back line, because I think the blame deserves to fall elsewhere on the pitch as well. But Orlando just, the shoulders are slumped. There's no effort to get back. They're jogging back. Piatti's wide open. There's nobody near him. He's just left completely isolated. How does Piatti end up with that much space that late in the game? And there's just no desire, there's no fight whatsoever, and there seems to be no plan, which of course then leads to, well, maybe not of course. I was actually a little surprised by the news that Orlando then swiftly parted ways with Jason Kreis.
I don't know if it's maybe the acquisitions they made in the offseason were, or if it's just two bad results in a row, because they're still a playoff team. I don't think their positions were hurt too bad by that specific result, because both New England and Chicago, who are kind of their peer teams, both got draws. So It didn't really hurt them the most. But they are in kind of a dangerous scenario where the Union and Chicago are definitely showing signs of life. But maybe there was just an expectation there that was not fulfilled in terms of what people were hoping for from Kreis.
Sure. I mean, since joining MLS, Orlando's front office has always had a very ambitious goal of wanting to win and wanting to win now and investing a hell of a lot of money into it. And I think... maybe they just got a little bit frustrated with that. They kind of let Jason Kreis do whatever he wanted. He got all the players he wanted. He was able to bring in the likes of Dwyer, of Clushton, of Justin Merrum. They basically kind of gave him a blank check and to rebuild the team, and he did. And then to see things just go so terribly south, even when Orlando kind of had a stretch of okay games, they never quite fully clicked into full gear. And so I think it has less to do with how the players are on the pitch or who the players on the pitch are, but how they're being organized, how they're being trained, that you've got all of this talent and yet it's not leading to any sort of meaningful result, that the frustration came in. I still think it's a bit of a gamble at this point in the season of who do you bring in? Because they brought in Kreis because they wanted somebody who specifically had a lot of MLS experience. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to imagine what the next move for them is. There's lots of names being tossed around. The only one that really seems to make much sense to me right now is our old buddy Caleb Porter.
Yeah, you know, you always thought when Porter and Portland. Split ways that Porter was going on to something good next. You know what I mean? I can't remember if it was mutual or if it was a firing, but regardless, Porter,
I believe it was mutual, but I think it was actually initiated by Porter.
You would think that, you know, that's sort of something that I kind of forgot. I was like, oh, well, I'm excited to see what Porter's next move is. And then it was nothing. Just a little bit of a surprise.
I think the fortunate thing for coaches, unlike players, is that, you know, sometimes you can afford yourself a little bit of time off and waiting to find the right thing. I believe the Caleb Porter situation at Portland came to a close of he was kind of like, I've done everything I needed to do with Portland, and I want a new challenge. And, you know, he put his stamp on that club, got them into a good place, and decided he needed something different. I mean, what better project than Orlando right now to prove that you really are a great coach? Yeah. As well as a pretty good situation to come into when you've got, you know, the former king of assists in MLS as one of your main central players. You've got the fantastic, if inconsistent, speed and ability of Dom Dwyer. Like, this team, perhaps all they need is a bit of readjustment and a change of coaching staff and could be a force to be reckoned with. I don't necessarily know that that's Caleb Porter that's going to do that. But I mean, his track record is pretty good, and maybe this is the type of challenge he's looking for.
The indictment on Jason Kreis is that you look at those front players and you know that the pieces are there. Like the previous conversation we were having about defense, defensive staff is pretty anonymous. Partially that's because they have a couple of injuries and a suspension on that front. So that's pretty much the same as, you know, it's pretty much the same deal as you have a lot invested in the front, not as much invested in the defense. This is a great place for a manager to come into, which is kind of an indictment. You know, if you look at the pieces and you say that the pieces are there, then you ask why the manager wasn't able to put them together. The question I have for Jason Kreis in terms of what's next is I've always liked Kreis since he was in RSL. I wonder whether being poached out of RSL to be the star debut manager of New York City was a poor choice for him. Not necessarily because he wasn't ready for the spotlight, but I feel like the RSL, the position that he was in, was really good for him. It was his first club as a manager. It was the club that he played for as a player. And just regular manager Jason Kreis was great. Managing genius Jason Kreis has not been as... It's not been as successful.
No, I think that's a really, really good point. And I don't know if it comes down to managing certain types of players and their egos, but yeah, I think he had a good thing going, and there's a lot of pressure on, you know, coaches that show promise to move on up and to take on new challenges. But, you know, just as players move around so much now, so do coaches. And there might be something to say... be said for just spending 4, 5, 6 years in one place and building something there, and, you know, really getting to understand that's how long it takes to build a team. You can't build a team in a year. You can't build it in even 3 years. You can have great results and a great team. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes that's when coaches are inheriting it. And we see it all in Europe all the time, where a coach comes in and a team's doing really well and they're like, oh, this is the most brilliant coach ever. But they've really only bought 3 or 4 new players. They've inherited a very good team, changed a couple of things, and then had success with it. Far more rare is it for us to see a coach kind of come into their own and slowly build a team up and make something of a project of it. So, yeah, I'm not sure, but I think you're onto something in that this maybe, you know, the eyes are a little wider than the plate in terms of what he can take on and what his ability as a manager is, could play into this.
Your the unfortunate thing for Kreis is that RSL has a manager now, your fave, Mike Becky. Can't exactly go back there. I don't know. I don't know if the carousel, you're right in saying that the next person on the carousel for this job opening is Porter. I wonder if Kreis maybe is now just going to chill out until Ziggy Schmidt maybe makes a departure from LA.
You know what? That's a great point. My thought was when Adrian Heath gets fired from Minnesota, Jason Kreis will be there once again to take his job, as he did from Orlando. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to poke too much fun. Coaching is a hard job, and I think with very few exceptions, most of the coaches in MLS are great and are doing what they can with what they have. And I do feel like Jason Kreis is maybe a little hard done by, but you know, when the front office has invested so much money in your project and the project isn't working, at some point it's got to give. And you know, it's a World Cup break. They've bought themselves a little bit of time to be able to reassess. And, you know, let's not be naive. I'm sure they've been looking this whole time in case the project didn't work out. So
I'm trying to think here. Is this the first one of the year? Is this the first coach firing of the year? I think
it is. I can't. Yeah.
Some leagues track this. It's impressive that it took this long, I guess.
It's also notable that why is it notable? Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
It's notable that it comes this far in the season, or it's notable that there hasn't been one yet.
Well, it's notable that there hasn't been one yet, but it's notable that they're also, this is not a team that's at the bottom of the table.
Yes.
This is a team that, despite a recent run of very poor form, is still in playoff contention at this point. So that's, I think, where people are rightly sort of going, well, is this the right call? Because if you give Jason Kreis, you know, another couple of months, do you not maybe wait until when you're sure you're out of the playoff picture, and then you give yourself a few months of just like, whatever, throw the assistant coach in while we look for a new coach. But what if he's able to turn it around, get a few more points, and then all of a sudden they're sitting fourth in the league and are in the playoffs with a shout and actually have a shot? You know, it seems like Orlando's patience is mighty thin.
I don't know, because, well, it is what it is a test of a theory. One of the things that I talked to you about, and I wasn't sure how bitter or not bitter I felt about this, was the fact that, you know, it was kind of two results on the bounce for Orlando, the 5-2 Vancouver win and the 3-0 Montreal win, where they got blown out in quick succession by teams. Well, Vancouver's doing okay. They're in a playoff position, but teams that are not necessarily the number one teams in the league, getting blown up by those teams in two quick successions. And also, I guess it's six in a row. So it's not just that. It's 3-0 to New York, 5-2 to the Whitecaps, 3-0 to the Impact, which is a story of, you know, escalating failures in 3-0, in three goal losses. But I kind of thought that the kind of, what I've always been looking for in the Whitecaps' situation is intensity. What I feel like some people have been looking for is accountability. And if that's what you want, that's what Orlando is going to get. That is the approach that they are taking, which is, we have this playoff position. We want to secure this playoff position, and we are willing to take action. It is kind of funny when you look at their results, because Orlando did go, you know, draw, loss, and then have six wins in a row and six losses in a row. So a kind of consistency.
Indeed.
They whatever they had in this season, they got all at once and then lost it all at once. So this is the club kind of saying, you know, this is not how we want it to be, and we want, it's been six in a row, we want to keep our position, and we are going to see whether or not that approach is successful.
Yeah. We shall see what happens. Elsewhere in the Eastern Conference, Columbus played Atlanta in a game that I don't think had too much in it, but I thought Columbus looked good for much of it, had a couple of early chances, couldn't quite make it land, And then, of course, Martinez does what Martinez does, scores a goal, sustained a nasty knock and could be out, so that could have possible implications for them. But for a team that's just been given such a blank check by the league and by fans to just say, well, Atlanta's the best team and it's so amazing, I thought Columbus put up a great fight, and it's unfortunate that they couldn't get anything out of this one. But I certainly felt like they took the game to Atlanta a little bit more clinical, and this one might have been a draw, might have been a 2-1. But despite being blanked at home, I felt like we still saw this wasn't Columbus collapsing. This was Columbus showing some of the things they needed to continue to work on. But they didn't give up bad goals and also created a lot of chances. So definitely a game, I feel anyway, where the end result doesn't really match what happened on the pitch, because Columbus really looked good for most of this one.
Well, Columbus really sneaks up on you, because the biggest thing, unfortunately it's a loss, but they mentioned that it breaks a 9-game unbeaten streak, which is impressive. We've been saying that Columbus is doing really well in exceeding expectations this year, but I kind of didn't realize by how much. Like you said, I think it's just sort of down to, I didn't get too much out of this. Atlanta's just really good. Martinez, basically what happened with him was he came up for a header and headed the goal in, and then his follow through, his head continued to go through, and he hit the defender in front of him and broke his nose.
I thought one of his neck tattoos came loose.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that was also, the trainers were also looking at that. It's a weird state we're in where that's kind of a preferable result to a concussion.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't brain injury is really serious and really dangerous, a broken nose is bad, but I admit that I saw that just now and I was like, oh, just a broken nose.
Yeah. It'll hurt like shit, but you can play with a broken nose.
He is listed as questionable for the team's Wednesday game in the U.S. Open Cup.
Yeah, I'd imagine they'd rest him for that one and wait for the next MLS match, but I think we can expect to see even more terrifying Martinez in a face mask of some sort playing. He's just far too important of a player. If he can stand on two legs, or even on one leg, he'll be on the pitch.
I think you're right to say that this says more about Atlanta than it does about Columbus.
Yeah, and, I mean, looking at the table, Columbus is 1 point behind New York City FC. They've given up only 16 goals, which is third best in the Eastern Conference. They're tied with New York Red Bulls in terms of goals conceded. So defensively, they've been quite sound, and credit to them. So many teams have been blown out by Atlanta this season and last. And I thought, you know, things didn't quite go their way. But for me, what really tells the story for Columbus is that they just need to be a little bit more clinical in their finishing, that they do only have 22 goals for. So they're in the position they're in because of their defending and because of their team effort. But it's a very low return that is happening for them right now. And, you know, as good as Zardes has been and some of their other players, they need to start putting some of those ones away. And early on, they had a couple of chances. This could have been Columbus up by 20 minutes into the match. I don't doubt that Atlanta still would have gotten the goals, but they possibly could have hung on for a point. So I'm not sure what's up for Columbus this summer, if they're planning on making any moves. I think their major move was in Zardes. I think one of the things they may be missing is that pacey winger to be feeding balls into the box, but they got to have the person in the middle to put them away.
Yeah. We were talking about Toronto's rehabilitation project. Seattle's rehabilitation project, as much as they are still far behind Toronto in points with 11 to 15, they came up against sort of one of the hot teams in the league, the Red Bulls. They were also not able to convert with a 2-1 victory for New York. What did you think of this one?
Another one where I thought this said a little bit more about the Red Bulls than the Sounders, that they've been slipping a little bit as of late. Their slips have usually meant either winning by a hair or drawing.
Yep.
But we definitely saw still signs of weakness there. However, I mean, the combination between Royer and Velo in this game was just one of the tastiest plays that happened.
Oh, yeah.
And
he sends, Velo sends a ball. Somehow he kicks, we're well aware of the effects of curving in how you curve a ball. He curved the ball around the defense. I don't fault Seattle's defense for this. He was in an onside position and somehow reached a player.
And the defender's
in
the right position as well to block to block the cross. Like, yeah, I agree. And thank you all, sir. I felt really bad for the defender because, like, what are you going to do when a cross comes in that's low but also just curls perfectly around you? You're in the right position. You're tracking both the line of the pass and the player behind you, trying to double up and cut down the play. And it's just, yeah, one of the most fantastic passes I've seen this season, and just puts it on a plate for Daniel Royer. However, we saw, you know, New York could have made this one 4-1.
Yeah.
Missing a lot of sitters. And I believe it was Royer who missed a sitter shortly after that. And good for Seattle for clawing their way back. My major takeaway from this one was that New York needs to find that special something to inject a little bit of life into them where they've started to slide. But, you know, when you're sliding and you're still beating teams,
yeah.
And Seattle looked much better in this one. And I love the idea that, you know, when your team is not scoring goals, anybody can score a goal. And Harry Shipp, of all people,
yes.
Harry Shipp just comes in and just slides in an absolute little peach just to give them some hope.
If Seattle had more going forward, that's something they could have capitalized on, but they didn't, so they didn't.
It's true. And I just wonder that, you know, how long does Seattle place faith in certain forward players before they decide to move them on and just look for a new era of the Sounders. Dempsey looked particularly bad in this game. Credit to him for getting back and trying to defend, but he really did just look like an old man lost in the supermarket back there.
So I didn't see the game itself. Dempsey is listed on the MLS website for this game, or like the MLS lineups for this game, as a defender. Did he take a defender off, and that's why they? Oh yeah, he took Tony Alfaro off. I assume he didn't play in defense.
I'm not sure exactly what happened, but it wasn't good.
You
just realize, like, whatever extra bit of pace and physicality that Dempsey used to have, I think is gone. And I don't know if it's related to the health problem he had last year or whatever, but it just seems like it's a little bit beyond his reach right now. And I don't see him being the talisman for Seattle that they really need. And I just, again, I wonder how long do they continue to put their faith in him, a player that's put a tremendous amount of faith in the club, before they need to make some decisions about what to do there.
I think Dempsey, as much as I agree with you, I think Dempsey has been used in the right way, which is a forward coming off the bench. I don't think they've been putting everything on him. I think they've been putting everything on Will Bruin as the target striker. And Bruin's been doing his best, but he is not necessarily that player. And I think that as you continue to look at the growing, mounting rumors that The Seattle Sounders are about to pick up Raul Ruidíaz, who is a striker. I think that striker in Liga MX, I believe. I think that would be a great pickup for them. There is a hole in the front line since Jordan Morris got his injury, and the Peruvian striker could be the man to fill it.
Could well be. We've got two more games from the league. A guy that you talked about a lot last week and have brought up a few times, and I've been sort of paying attention to, but this game was like, oh, I see you now, Katai.
Yeah!
Colorado and Chicago. Colorado comes in, storms the house 15 minutes in, they're two goals up, and then go all Colorado on it. Chicago was all Chicago for the first 15 minutes, and then spring to life and catch them on the back foot. But for me, this one is a well-deserved point, and Alexander Katai just... that goal's ridiculous. He's such a good player, and he's a team player that seems to understand his teammates, and he hasn't been with the team long, but also just kind of out of nothing can just create something and and finish it.
This was a game kind of hilariously that, you know, all happened in the first 25 minutes in terms of goals. Baji, Tommy Smith to Dominic Baji to open, and then Smith scores himself with a header. But you're right, Alexander Katai, he creates the own goal on the 21st minute and then puts one in himself. This beautiful rising and falling ball. You can somewhat fault Chicago for having to wake up like that, you know, having to get stunned. If there's a possibility, and if they would like to unseat Orlando for that sixth playoff position, they need to be starting the games, and not in the first minute and not the 20th minute. But this was a good result for them. A rare example this year of a Eastern team beating a Western team. Now it's Colorado, but that hasn't been happening too much. Katai looks really good, and he was sort of a... We've talked about this before, that he was sort of an ensemble player previously, and then sort of was able to expand his role this season.
Mm-hmm. And it should be noted, too, he is on loan as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's on loan from a team whose name I don't want to try to pronounce, because it's Spanish, and I'm very self-conscious about my Spanish right now.
Let's see if I can find that, and I'll try.
Alaves?
Yes. Oh, I didn't know that. He's the man's got quality.
He's got great quality. The thing to me about the storyline for me of this match should be 24 minutes in, it's 2-2, and then what the fuck happens for the rest of this match? And the answer is not much.
They settle in. It didn't seem from the highlights that a lot was going on other than that.
Go ahead.
I had joined this game in the last half hour after the TFC game on Wednesday, and I leapt out of my seat when I heard a commentary call that Bastian Schweinsteiger was getting sent off for putting his hand on somebody's face. But it was wrong. They were wrong. Instead, Johan Kapelhoff had put his boot on someone's face.
It's a big difference.
He was coming up to challenge for a ball. He got none of the ball and got all the face.
Kapelhoff has had a very up and down season for such a stalwart defender. The notable thing to me about this game was just that, like, seriously, what happened for the rest of the game? Just taking the pressure off, and Colorado has shown that they can be a team with immense speed and great counterattack. And Chicago has so much talent on their bench. It's just really surprising to me that this one had to end a 2-2 draw with three quarters of a game to play.
Well, I'm trying to find out. I'm trying to find split off stats. Chicago had most of the, had 64% possession, 65% the whole game, and they had most of the second half as well. I'm trying to find the split off stats that show what went on in that second half, but yeah, they didn't seem to get a lot. They didn't seem to get a lot going on.
Now, elsewhere in the league, New England faltered a little bit and has been kind of slipping up as of late. But watching the San Jose-New England game, I actually thought this was a good fight from San Jose to just scrounge out a point and show that they're not dead yet. However, it's a little bit concerning that whenever that happens, there's really only one player behind it, and that's Danny Huijsen for a 2-2 draw.
That was this was something that San Jose really needed. It's true that it all comes from Huijsen. But I think that it's, you know, you can't quite Huijsen's been on the pitch all the time for lots of games that they have not been successful at. So their ability to use the asset that they have to win games was good. The first goal was solid. That header at the very beginning of the second half really helps change the game for San Jose and prevents more stuff. I think that what's the most unfortunate for New England is that they had two very pretty goals, including a beautiful free kick from Diego
Fagundes. I'm watching it on loop right now, the Fagundes one.
I'm watching it on loop every time I close my eyes. Like it's
it really is the epitome of like a curling, dipping, hard, low free kick. It's perfect. Mm-hmm.
This is a draw from New England out of conference. It's fine for New England out of conference, but when you look at the quality of what they put together, they really could have, you really would have hoped for more from them.
Yeah, I think that certainly one of these goals was preventable, and that continues to just be a little bit of the Achilles heel for New England, but I'm excited to see what they do. I think this is a team that's firmly gonna, I think at this point safe to say, I hope it's safe to say they'll be in the playoffs. I'd like them to be in the playoffs, because they're always just a bit of a wild card, and you're not quite sure of what New England is going to show up, but they've quietly put together a pretty good season so far. And, it's easy to say maybe a draw against San Jose is not the result that you want.
Yeah.
With San Jose sitting second from the bottom, tied for points with DC United, and only poor Colorado Rapids with 9 points. But San Jose, this was the same as last year. San Jose continues to show its quality. And it's, here's a stat that I think, you know, the table doesn't tell everything. But, you know, Seattle has, sorry, I'm getting my things crossed now. San Jose has 24 goals for, which is a pretty good showing.
That's true.
And is more goals than 5th and 6th right now in the Western Conference. Above them, with only 10 goals for, is Seattle. The difference is Seattle's only given up 17 goals, and San Jose has given up 31.
Wow.
And they both have a goal difference of minus 7. Oh, and this is one of those things where I go, the table doesn't tell the whole story, but it does tell a story. In that San Jose needs to tighten things up. We know they can score goals, but my goodness, they need to make some moves at the back. The most goals conceded in MLS, tied only with Montreal Impact and Orlando SC.
My take on it, when you look at the table, and this is a good time to sort of look where things shape up, so the six playoff teams, Sporting Kansas City, FC Dallas, LAFC, Whitecaps, RSL, and Portland, in the Western Conference, with RSL and Portland on 22. Then underneath it, you've got Houston, LA, Minnesota, Seattle at San Jose, and Colorado at the bottom. My take on that, when you compare the sort of the point spread to the Eastern Conference, is both, and I think this is reflected in San Jose's point total as well, that there's just the underbelly of the Western Conference is much harder to punch through. Because if you look at a team that's in that 10th, 11th position, or only 11 teams in the East and 12 in the West, you look at Chicago, this is the Toronto question. You look at Chicago, Philadelphia, Montreal, and you think, that's possible. It's possible to be better than all three of those teams. And then you look at the team in the sixth position, Orlando, and you say, it's possible to get through that. And mm-hmm. Orlando is the highest positioned on that out of 19 points. And you look at the teams above San Jose, and for the sake of argument of Seattle also being on a rehabilitation tour, the teams above Seattle, and it's Houston, L.A., Minnesota, with Houston in seventh on 21, and then the bottom two teams in the West are RSL and Portland on 22 and 22. That's way harder to match because Houston and L.A., by my estimation, are playing lower than their quality level, and mm-hmm. RSL and Portland have a high quality level. So it's way harder to get through that to make your way up the table at this point in the season in the West than it is in the East. And I think that if they had a slightly easier conference, perhaps San Jose would not be on 10 points. But here we are.
Here we are.
Who was your team of the week?
Oh, yeah, I should have thought about that earlier.
I can tell you that my goal is Fagundes, so that's my goal of the week.
I just watched it about 57 times on repeat while we were talking. I still think mine's Katai's goal.
Nice. Yeah, no, that one was
the
off well.
The bar one is just a peach. My team of the week. This is a hard one. How do you possibly pick with these results?
Half the teams didn't play. That's right. most of them were draws.
And the teams that played weren't great. You know what? I'm just gonna do it. My team of the week is DC United. Yes, they gave up a game that they should have handily won against a wounded animal in Toronto. However, this is a great positive to see from DC scoring this many goals. They're about to move into their new stadium. I haven't heard any Rooney news lately, but that seems like it's a thing that's going to happen. They still, like every other MLS team we talk about, need to tighten things up at the back, but it's easy to talk about Toronto and what they could do with a couple of results. And DC United has not made it easy for themselves. However, it's also important to note that they have two games in hand behind Toronto. Which, if those were two wins, conceivably, that puts them at 16 points, which bumps them into ninth place. Chicago and Philadelphia are what they are. If DC can put together some performances and lock things up a little bit at the back, I'm not saying they're playoff contention, but they could be the team that keeps Toronto out. And I thought this was as good of a performance from DC as it was from Toronto, with a whole lot of problems. But if I'm looking at the other results from the week, it's really hard to pick a team that showed more like take it to them and see what we can do. Yeah. It's unfortunate it didn't extend to the rest of the team. But that's my pick. Who's your team of the week?
That's definitely the quality that they have in it. And it's all gonna. It sets up this gamble they're going to take on Audi Field and Wayne Rooney, you know? If the base is there. It wasn't able to get more than 10 points, but it's there. My team of the week is going to be... I was going to say New York, but you did a great job of pointing out how they are not as good as they could be. So I am...
It's hard, right?
I'm gonna still say New York because this is the sort of result that, you know, you got to turn. If sure. for no reason other than Danny Royer's amazing, when he gets his shot that it looks like Fry may have fell backwards into the goal. One of the first times I've ever seen a player doing this, the player yells at the referee and makes the VAR signal with his hands.
Yeah. And I do believe Fry kept it out, but that shot came in so fast it did knock him a little off his feet.
Yes. Elsewhere, we were talking about doing a little. Other North American stuff. Now that we're in the 9-game break. What did you get to see? What were you looking at?
So, admittedly, I looked at NWSL first because USL makes me want to cry myself to sleep sometimes. And I think largely it's a marketing thing. It's at times very hard to follow. And it's a little sort of ramshackle, which I normally love, but I think NWSL is just an easier league to follow, and that does matter as a fan of having easily accessible games that you can stream, and great highlights. So I caught myself up a little bit there, which was mostly going, okay, obviously I'm going to look at Portland Thorns first because Christine Sinclair, who I just recently learned shares my birthday.
Nice.
And, you know, is our national savior of soccer. That's who I'm drawn to first. And then I go, wait, who's North Carolina Courage sitting at the top of the table, who until very recently was undefeated this season?
That's right.
And is 11 points clear of second place. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why this team is doing so well, because I'm going, sure, they've got to have some sort of talisman player. And sure enough, it seems like it's good old-fashioned goals by committee. And so I went back and watched some highlights from their games. And this team is a team you don't fuck with.
Yeah, absolutely. So
they've got 5 or 6, 7 goal scorers in every game. It's super, super... it's fantastic. It's just bizarre.
So North Carolina Courage were the Western New York Flash previously. They had been moved. They had been moved in 2017, the year after the Flash. I can't remember. I believe the Flash did win that the 2016 final. So when in 2017 when they got the when they when North Carolina, because it's associated with the North Carolina FC USL team as well. They did. Yeah, they won the Flash had won their first NWSL championship in their final season. Unfortunately, since then, I think what you see is you see the head coach Paul Riley, who had come out of the Thorns, built a really successful team. And I'm looking at their their roster now. The top forwards of Jess McDonald, Lynn Williams, and Crystal Dunn are great and have always been great. And having those three, Dunn has had a great career with the U.S. Women's National Team. But Williams and McDonald are right there coming up as well.
Absolutely, and again, they've got goals by committee and plenty of talent around the field, but I knew I'd eventually figure out there was some player that was the extra little spark here, and I think it's Crystal Dunn.
Yeah.
And I was like, I know that name, and I was like, okay, all right, because she's punished us Canadians and the U.S. national team before. But just, to me, a perfect example of the new age of North American women's player that is an incredibly physical player, but incredibly nimble, great ball handling. You know, she started with Washington Spirit. She had a little spell at Chelsea, which is a good club to be associated with.
Yeah.
And, you know, now has 4 goals in 9 games. But just watching some highlights of the way that she plays, of, you know, a very smart player that finds the spaces, finds little pockets, a great dribbler of the ball, but is also you know, she's not a big player. She's just over 5 foot. She plays like a 6 foot tall player. Mm-hmm. She's got the shoulders out. She's got the on-field presence of a player that's much larger. And that's the way the women's game is going, I think. It's a far more physical game. And you need to be able to go shoulder to shoulder with people. Mm-hmm. And she's just pushing through them with ease. And it's not because she's short. It's because she's strong as shit.
Yeah. She's really good. She's one of a couple of players that have come back. Sort of a couple of years ago, you had some key players drop out of the NWSL to head to Europe. Heather O'Reilly was one who went to Arsenal. Don went to Chelsea. We had R2 Ashley Lawrence went to PSG. Ashley Lawrence went to PSG. And a couple people chose that route instead of doing NWSL. And you're now seeing Crystal Dunn come back. You're seeing Houston had someone too. Carly Lloyd came back to the Houston Dash.
Yeah.
As well. And I think that's helping raise the quality a little bit. And the players are coming back with seasoning. Unfortunately, the one sort of negative mark on North Carolina Courage's record, in addition to the loss that they just had, is this Jalen Hinkle situation, who is somebody, you know, in a great way. The U.S. Women's National Team in the NWSL has been very supportive of the Pride community, including these Pride numbers. And it was revealed that Jalene Hinkle turned down a call-up to the U.S. Women's National Team because she didn't want to wear the numbers, which was really, really unfortunate for some people. And what she's saying, and I think that there's a little bit of... I'm not going to make any definitive words on what needs to happen because I haven't been, you know, around that enough. But I have just heard that people are looking for a little accountability and a little they are bothered by this, and there needs to be some makeup for the fact that this happened.
Yeah, I mean. Quite apart from my own politics, I believe it was a player from Croatia got sent home this week for refusing to come on as a substitute, regardless of what the injury is. But especially for something that you don't want to wear numbers that have a rainbow pattern on them, that's fine. It's totally fine. But there should be repercussions, and simply, you're gone. You don't play. If that's the thing that you're so moved by, and the cross that you need to bear, then you don't play. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. And not just, you know, you're benched for the next game. What does it say about a player that, again, outside of what your personal politics are, what does it say about a player that refuses to play because of something so seemingly insignificant and small in the grand scheme of things? Soccer's always been a sport that's tried to be about bringing people together. Mm-hmm. Or certainly that's the story that's told. I mean, I know that the reality can often be quite different, but for right now, like, just fine. You're out. You don't play. Like, go find a team then. Go play elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that there's been that response.
Somebody said...
And especially in this league, I feel like the NWSL has done such a good job of sticking its neck out. And especially certain teams like Orlando Pride really embracing certain communities and making space for them. There's no room for a player like that.
She had previously made anti-gay marriage comments in 2015. what had happened this time is that somebody... Or was this all... Right. So, for some reason, these are all saying 2017. Ah, right. This had happened before. So this had happened before in 2017. Okay. All right. So this all happened in 2017. That she didn't do the call up. And she had cited personal reasons. But then in an interview that was just released at the end of, released at the end of May, she said that, you know, she did it because she didn't want to wear the pride numbers. Quote, if I never get another national team call up again, that's just part of his plan. That's okay. Maybe that's why you're meant to play soccer, to show other believers to be obedient.
Go fuck yourself.
It wasn't my job to wear this jersey, you know? And
what does that even mean? It doesn't even make sense.
A big shout out to the Portland Timbers or the Portland Thorns fans for booing the shit out of her. The next game after that interview was announced, including the phenomenal two stick that I'm looking at and will send you, that has written in pride in rainbow colored letters the words personal reasons.
Okay, and I don't want to take anything away from this, because you're 100% correct. 100% correct. And yes, Portland Thorns fans, we see you. But how did you come by such knowledge from a game that happened in 2017?
It was all, like I said, the interview where she confirmed that it was reasons, that these reasons were existent, happened at the end of May. That's what happened.
Sure.
Like the story, essentially the story broke at the end of May that was the reason. And so the controversy is all from the last 2 weeks.
Sure.
But the game happened back in 2017.
Right. What other games happened in 2017 that you watched this week?
Oh my God. So I wanted to watch an NWSL game because we wanted to do it while the break was happening. But in the United States, the games are streamed on Lifetime or the games are shown on TV in Lifetime and they're streamed on Go90. Well, in Canada, you can get all the games streamed for free on the NWSL website, but they're all on the stats page. So I went and looked up on my, one of my go-to websites, Live Soccer TV, what is like the NWSL games, and I turn the scores off. The next Portland game is against Houston. So I asked a friend, can you please go get me the stats page for Houston Portland? And they got me the one from August 2017. I watched all of it. I slept through half of it. This is how badly I'm doing at the NWSL this year, so I'm really sorry, NWSL fans. I'm going to do better. I'm going to try my best. It was a great game. It was a cracker of a game. Thorns won 2-1 last year.
No, but I'm glad you can own, like, okay, maybe we can do better than this.
We can do better than this.
Pay more attention.
Yeah.
And there's great storylines to follow that I also feel bad. I've sort of on and off follow Orlando Pride because obviously they brought in the wizard Marta. Mm-hmm. Follow Portland Thorns FC as well because I want to see our captain Christine Sinclair and what she's up to. Mm-hmm. But you know, I had a little bit of a moment today just watching some highlights from games and I just was like, oh yeah, there's always more soccer to watch.
The Pride had a great game against Sky Blue.
They did. Yeah, and after a pretty terrible season last year, or a season that didn't result in much, it's good to see them doing well again this season. And also a team that, if you want to talk about teams that really it embeds itself in a community and does all the right things. Orlando Pride, to me, is one of the best in North America for that.
Mm-hmm. The other big news from there, Sky Blue sent Adriana Leon to Seattle for just a draft pick, which seems crazy because... Leon is great and is great on the salary books, but does not have, I guess, wasn't really playing for Sky Blue. And the other one is that Christian Press, who is another one of these players who went off to Europe, was traded from Chicago to Houston and then just decided not to go, went to Sweden instead. A crazy...
So like MLS.
Just like MLS. If you're feeling the missing of MLS, you can feel glad because the player who didn't show up for training camp had her rights traded. Chicago traded the rights and a conditional first pick for Sofia Huerta, a striker, and Taylor Como, a midfielder, to the Houston Dash. So the player, Houston sent the player's rights back to the team who had her initially, and then the team that traded her away then traded Press's rights again and another player to the Utah Royals for Brooke Elby in the number one pick in the next draft.
Good God.
So Press is presumably, now that the European season has concluded, returning to NWSL after some time in Sweden for Utah, who also had a great game this week. 1-0 against North Carolina Courage. They're the one that broke that streak. They look like they're having a great time. And Orlando was a 3-2 win, by the way.
North American soccer is bananas sometimes. Mm-hmm. Quickly looking at USL, just to give people a brief little lowdown on it. I don't have too much to say about it beyond it shouldn't come as perhaps much of a surprise that FC Cincinnati sits firmly atop the table, 6 points clear of second place, has put together a fantastic season against our good friend Alan Koch. Uh-huh. Koch, did we decide how we pronounce the last
Koch?
Name? I think it's Koch. Koch. Alan Koch, formerly of our now defunct USL side, has done fantastic things with him. I hope he sticks around for the MLS side. I hope we get to see him as an MLS coach. If for nothing else, I want to see the firm handshake and nod between him and Carl Robinson if either of them survive until next season.
I would say that
against each other.
That the key thing with them is I would look at, if you are looking at a team that has elected to jump right into the league the year after their expansion is announced, instead of taking a little bit of time, as some teams have, to sort of get the lay of the land, that's a team that's ready to... That's a team that believes it's ready to move up in its current shape. And so I wouldn't imagine that you see them pick a different manager between now and then.
Yep, I agree. And I honestly believe they are. I think they're ready to compete. I think they'll struggle at first. But this is a team that, you know, they bring in 1, 2, 3 maybe different signings, and they've got a very competitive team. And I think, because they're going in the Eastern Conference, yeah?
I don't think that's been clarified, but I think yes, that would make sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine they can't compete with the likes of Chicago, Philadelphia, Orlando, New England, D.C., Toronto, if they don't pick things up. Yeah, things look good for them. The note I wanted to make about USL, and I know that, like, USL is a strange league because there's a few teams that have been there for a long time and they really pride themselves on that and they have an identity. I'm thinking the Riverhounds, I'm thinking Indy 11, Charleston Battery, Tampa Bay Rowdies. If you look down at the bottom, the very, 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 very bottom of the USL, what team do you see but TFC2, who still, 14 games in, have not won a single match, have only scored 13 goals and given up 33. And I just thought, you know, I don't want to draw too many comparisons here, but it does seem like from top to bottom, perhaps what we saw last year might have been an anomaly, and there might be bigger problems, and the system's just not set up to succeed. And, like, who's coming through these ranks? Why have this team? We saw Orlando, Montreal, and Vancouver fold their USL teams and sort of offload them elsewhere.
Yes.
And you know, we've talked about the possibility of Toronto's youth academy coming up, and they've invested money into it. It just seems interesting to see a team so I'm talking about the MLS team.
So moribund.
In such disarray. Yes. But really, like, what's coming up through the ranks? And, you know, I went and I looked and I tried to find the players of, like, well, something's got to be happening for TFC2. And there's startlingly little news about it. And so that's still a thing for me, is that USL seems to me like a tale of two leagues, where you have the actual league teams and then you have the B teams for MLS teams who really don't seem to invest anything in those teams. And even just trying to find out information about them is very difficult. Like, well, TFC2 is all but resigned to a dark corner, and I can't even find out who scored for them.
Well, I would say that if you kind of look at, I think that's sort of the issue there, is that, you know, a team that's its own team has its own news, you know, that it has its own city. TFC2 news is relegated to, like, sort of the very bottom of the news sort of tree for TFC fans themselves. I do think, and I'm looking for a team sheet to prove this for me. If you wonder, oh, what happened at TFC2? Where'd they all go? Well, the answer is they went up to play for TFC1, I think, during that sure. the USL thing. Ryan Telfer started their – I'm looking for the common ground in terms of their first match, their first mm-hmm. couple of matches before that happens. And you see Liam Fraser and Ryan Telfer, who had time up on the main roster. So maybe not the most, but I guess it's true. You never saw the call up. You never saw the call ups on defense when they really needed it. So there must not have been people weren't there, that the people that you needed to, you may have counted on, were not there to be called up. I do feel like that. I'm trying to determine whether or not, you know, it was depth that got called up. Not the most. I saw Cerbelli for a couple games. So maybe not the most. Maybe I overestimated a little bit. Jordan Hamilton got called up a little bit. Maybe
it's not,
it is what you said.
Been without any product. And USL is a league without any real identity or any real direction at this point. So it's not necessarily, I'm not trying to, like, damn all of TFC or all of USL in it. It's just like 2 points out of 14 games.
The identity is fucking ASL.
Yeah, kind of. Except it's kind of funny because the team just slightly above them is Atlanta United too. So who knows? I would love for USL to mean a little bit more. I was sad to see a Whitecaps 2 fold, and would have liked to see more matches. But as somebody that spends a lot of time at UBC, that was never really marketed towards people who actually lived and worked and were in that area. I still struggle to figure out what this league is about. And right now their hottest commodity is FC Cincinnati, who's headed out of the league. So it's a hard league to follow. It's not helped by spotty online streams. Very poor pitches and just seeming like a total overall lack of interest in what's going on in that league.
Yeah.
However, the thing that I kind of went to was, okay, but who's hot in the league? Not the teams, but the players. And a couple of folks came up. And I was looking at Carlton Belmar from Swope Park Rangers, which apparently I struggled with saying. And I went, oh, here's a tasty prospect and, like, a kid who's going to find himself with an MLS contract soon, I think.
Nice. Yeah.
And that's something I'd like to highlight a little bit more in the podcast, but even just in terms of how I absorb soccer is looking for players that show a bit of promise. And you forget sometimes, like, USL players aren't always young kids. I mean, he's 25. But in 719 minutes, he's got eight goals. I go, okay, this is a guy. This is one we should be looking out for.
I think that, you know, the issue, one of the big issues that I see is I'm for, you know, promotion relegation is in more than just being for promotion relegation. I'm for a pyramid. I'm for supporting your local team, and I'm for having sort of a sliding scale that in promotion relegation is the best way to sustain that in a healthy way. But it's clear what the U.S. Soccer Federation values, and they value this kind of big sprawling league to an NASL style, more concise, but more impact league. And in the current environment, the NWSL and hopefully also the Canadian Premier League, I think more than match it for excitement and ease of following.
Absolutely. I'm super excited for what comes from them.
Just in terms of any sort of North American influence at the World Cup, Mexico beat Germany, thereby reminding people not just that there are North American and South American teams that can play good soccer, but also that the biggest thing that I notice at the when on the 90th minute, once they finally secured the win, the commentators yelled, "The Central American country, false. That's not true. They're in the southern part of North America."
Indeed.
Other than
many
that,
an argument will be had over that conversation, but
you saw Roman Torres looked fine in Panama's loss. Armando Cooper looked less fine.
Panama, I believe, started the most MLS players with 4.
Nice. My biggest takeaway in Canada, Whitecaps manager Carl Robinson is a part of the broadcast team. Having all these MLS people be a part of the broadcast team, they did an interview with Bastian Schweinsteiger about what it felt like to lift the World Cup. And, man, it kind of feels like it kind of low-key trashes these MLS players to be like, well, you're not here now. You got a lot of free time now.
Remember when you won the World Cup and now you just play for Chicago Fire?
But I loved – we talk about Carl Robinson as having sort of a lack of accountability, or like, you know, the fine line stuff, right? Like it creates
– yeah, a lack of candor.
A lack of candor. And so to see him talk critically about soccer, I noted this on Twitter, to see him be very clear about what he thinks players' responsibility are in the moment is – fascinating, when he doesn't have to bruise egos and he doesn't have to worry about saving his own ass. It is fascinating to watch him talk about soccer.
Agreed.
We do have the league comes back this weekend, so we've got a slate of games.
That's true. Which on a technical note, and this is maybe a little bit of behind the curtain for, do we have fans? I feel like probably at least 2.
Shout out to our fans.
So on a logistic note, next week, if we can make it happen, we'll do a show on Monday. We'll record it. And then I'm gone for 2 weeks. I'm taking off. I'm leaving. And
You're on a mission.
I'm on a mission. I got to go to Cuba to figure some stuff out. Which probably means I'm going to watch a shit ton of soccer because Cuba's national television is mostly stolen satellite signals, so I'll actually be able to get a clear stream of most World Cup games. I'm not even joking. I'm dead serious. That's the case. Mm-hmm. They hack into satellites nearby, and you can't ever tell what's going to be on TV at a certain time, but it'll come through crystal clear. You just might be watching Game of Thrones with Spanish subtitles at noon. So we're going to have a guest fill in, I hope, anyway. Maybe I shouldn't announce it before it's confirmed, but there will still be shows, but I won't be there. So it'll, you know, be more coherent and perhaps with more actual citing of stats instead of feelings.
Oh, your insights are always welcome. I hope you have a wonderful trip to Cuba.
I was not fishing for compliments, but thank you.
I hope you have a wonderful trip to Cuba, and I look forward to hearing more about. I look forward to hearing about your adventures.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to absorb a little bit of Cuban baseball while I'm there. But I gotta find. There's gotta be some soccer going on.
No doubt.
There's gotta be.
For that last weekend, and while you're in Cuba, where can we find you online?
You can find me online on Twitter at ThatSoMLS. Where can we find you?
You can find me at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. I'm editor at Howler Magazine, whatahowler.com. And you can find this podcast at ThatSoMLS.com. And you can find it on iTunes and wherever podcasts are acquired.
You can do those things. Oh, P.S. Easter egg. I got into a Twitter fight with Jeb Borowski this week.
Yes! Oh, man.
Jeb Borowski, formerly of Vancouver Whitecaps, formerly of Montreal Impact, famous for shattering his nose on the pitch, defending for his life, a player I love a lot. He sent out a late-night tweet, and it just went through my brain the wrong way. And he was calling out Landon Donovan for supporting Mexico. And I read the supporting Mexico part because it was the same day as, like, more details came about separating children from families.
Uh-oh.
Coming into the U.S. And it just literally went through the brain the wrong way. And I made a snarky comment, and he responded quite fairly, in fact. And then I went back and I was like, oh, like, I felt a little touchy because a person I thought was a good person and a good player, I was picking up vibes of anti-immigrant stuff. And he was giving, what he was trying to say was, players don't seem to show passion until they are supported by massive corporations like Wells Fargo. And how come you never showed this kind of support for the U.S.? But now you're showing it for Mexico when you've got a ton of money behind you. And it went through the brain the wrong way. But we worked it out.
Well, our apologies to Jeb Borowski. It is another sign of how strange geopolitics and soccer can bump into each other from time to time.
Indeed, especially if you're a on-edge kind of person and politics is hard to avoid right now. And, of course, soccer is about politics. But it was good that we had a rational conversation about it over Twitter, no less, where I was like, wait a second, I think I misread this thing. And he was like, I think you might have. And I was like, okay. And he was like, hey, thanks for, like, saying that. Thanks for admitting that it went through your brain wrong. And I was like, I do it a lot, buddy. I do it a lot.
Well, for playing the man and not the ball, I got to say that's something that the referee might have a talking to about. So in the meantime, don't get sent off.
I won't do it. No touching.
No touching.